To proceed with the second case on our docket, and that would be McDonough versus Jankula Construction. And are the attorneys ready?
The appellant is ready, Your Honor.
All right, we can proceed with that case. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Peter Thomas on behalf of Paul and Ellen McDonough. If I may, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Consider this case in the context of a client who consults with an attorney on a project, and the attorney requires the client to sign an engagement letter, provide a $25,000 non-refundable retainer, upon the receipt of which the attorney says, "No, I've reconsidered the estimate I gave you, and now I think it's actually going to cost about $276,000 for this work." Client says, "Hey, wait a sec, I can't pay that kind of money. I thought it was going to be a lot less. Despite the fact I know we've refined some things and added some additional scope, I can't pay that much." Attorney doesn't want to lose that business, so he negotiates with the client. The attorney offers, "Tell you what, I'll do it for $250,000. Is that still an estimate? Or has that attorney just agreed to do the project for a flat fee? Take it a little further. The attorney then works for months on the project, never sends the client an invoice until a few days before he's done. Legal fees have now suddenly ballooned to almost $400,000. Client gets the invoice, they get in a dispute, and the client says, "Hey, wait a second. I thought you said you were going to do this work for $250,000. Subject, of course, to any changes for additional work that wasn't contemplated at the time. And the lawyer says, "Well, I know that's what I said, but that's not what I meant. Because in my mind, what I meant was that I was really going to give you a $26,274.80 discount off of whatever my normal hourly rate might be." The lawyer then goes on to say, "And since you didn't know that, I'm not going to honor that discount either." And he turns around and sues his client. Would we condone conduct like this from a lawyer? Is it the policy of this state to allow licensed professionals in whom the public places their trust to make representations on which the public can't rely? Because that's exactly what JCI did in the instant case. The fundamental error by the trial court here was that it attempted to reallocate the risks and obligations that the parties and the opportunities that the parties had contractually agreed to. It's frequently said that, you know, if freedom of contract means anything, it's the freedom of parties to enter contracts and allocate risk and opportunities between themselves. It's undisputed that the parties agreed to at least one of two things. We believe the plain language of the offer, "I'll do that job for $250,000, is unequivocal on its face. But even if you accept JCI's own theory of the case that, "No, that's not what I meant though, I was just gonna give you a $26,000, $274.80 discount," one of those two things should be enforced. The court, however, strained to find some way to relieve JCI from either obligation by claiming that there was no meeting of the minds as to what JCI meant when it said, "I'll do the job for $250,000. JCI's arguments in court and its testimony were nothing but post hoc explanations in order to try to inject a self-serving and self-described ambiguity and words that on their face are plain.
Excuse me, counsel, let me ask you a question. I want to know from your perspective, what is our standard of review here? How are we to review the court's determination that
the Court of Appeals review of a contract, whether a contract or an enforceable promise was entered, is de novo.
So you're saying that whether a contract exists is a de novo review, or whether it's a contract that does exist is enforceable as a de novo review? Because didn't the court here say there is no contract?
It did, Your Honor.
Is that a question of fact?
Both of your questions would be de novo reviews, both whether or not there was a contract that was entered or whether or not there was a promise that was entered. You know, as you note, the contract or the court indicated that there's no enforceable contract, which is a question of fact, and also there's no enforceable promise, which also is a question of fact.
But let's go back to the first one. The court said, on the issue of contract, as I understand it, the court said there is no contract because there was no meeting of the minds. So if that's a question of fact, don't we defer to the trial court's findings unless they're clearly erroneous?
Well, when I say it's a question of fact, obviously you have to look at the common canons of contract construction. Was there an offer, acceptance, supported by consideration, and so forth? Whether or not the trial court erred in its determination would be a legal question that you have the right to review on a de novo basis. The case turns, and the reason it is important that there are one of two things that were promised by JCI, even as following JCI's own theory, is that because that leads directly into the core question of the excessive lien. JCI promised to do it for $250,000, but if you ascribe to their theory that no, it was only going to be a $26,000 discount, they did neither of those. In fact, they intentionally added that $26,000 back into the statement of lien. The trial court made an erroneous finding of fact on which a large part of its ruling is in fact predicated. The trial court said that JCI didn't intend to overlien the property. The trial court acknowledges that there are, quote, no reasonable probability that JCI is entitled to the $116,000 lien, but then goes to characterize it as an honest mistake. In so doing, the trial court completely overlooks and makes no reference in its ruling to the unequivocal admission by Norm Batchelder, who is an agent of JCI, who testified under cross-examination and admitted, I intended to include that $26,000 in the lien. Ken Jankla also admits that he knows the $26,000 is in the lien. He admits that he's not entitled to the $26,000 that's in the lien. He admits he's made no effort to modify the lien or reduce the lien. This is a textbook case of what the excessive lien statute is designed to protect against. It's designed to protect the public against exactly this sort of behavior by contractors.
Excuse me, counsel, let me ask you on this particular issue, what is our standard of review on the court's finding here with regard to JCI's knowledge of the inclusion of the credit or the negotiated adjustment in the lien?
If there was a question of credibility, where the court was weighing the relative credibility of the witnesses as far as what one party intended or not, we would probably have some difficulties here because you would have to defer to the trial court's determination of the party's credibility or intent. But here, where you have a party who admits straight out, I intended to include the $26,000 in the lien, and the trial court simply overlooks that testimony or ignores it in its ruling, that would not be something where you need to defer because, once again, the court simply failed to consider that pivotal testimony by the defendant.
So what's our standard of review?
I don't have that off the top of my tongue for you, Your Honor.
Let me ask a question about the scope of what we're being asked to decide here. In the trial court and in your notice of appeal, on the trial court, you had several claims for relief, including a civil theft claim and a negligent misrepresentation claim, both of which were also denied by the trial court.
Correct.
In your notice of appeal, you refer to both of those, but then when we get to the briefs, there's no mention of those two claims. Have you abandoned those two claims for purposes of this appeal?
For purposes of this appeal, we have, Your Honor. The sole focus of this appeal is, A, is there a contract that was formed and enforceable? If not, isn't there a promise that was made that the court needs to enforce? And assuming there is a contract and or a promise that is enforceable, it's axiomatic that the lien is excessive because JCI intentionally included the $26,000 in the lien at the very minimum that it knew it wasn't entitled to receive.
Mr. Thomas, I've just wanted to ask you your position on your opposing counsel's statement in their brief that you would not be entitled to raise on appeal the contract issue because you did not plead a breach of contract in the trial court.
And that's simply not true. Our second claim for relief in our initial complaint and also in the amended complaint is for an implied contract. And as we discussed throughout our trial brief, which was implicitly acknowledged by the court in its ruling, there is no meaningful distinction between an implied contract, an express contract, an oral or written contract. It's really a question of manifestation of intent. In fact, one of the leading commentators, Corbin on contracts, says that the distinction between an express and an implied contract, therefore, is of little importance if it can be said to exist at all. Any further questions? Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Timothy Witsit of the law firm of Witsit and Gross, bar number 5962, representing Jankla Construction, Inc., the appellee cross-appellant in this case. With me at council table this morning is Eric Gross and Adrian Roberry, who also participate in the briefing in this case. May it please the court, we certainly have a different point of view as to the issues and what went on in this case. And in fact, what we are dealing with here is, first of all, a trial court decision which was extremely thorough, extremely detailed. It was over 20 pages long with 170 separate numbered findings of fact. This is a court who did, I believe, a very thorough and excellent job. We don't necessarily agree with every single finding and everything that went on. That's obvious from the fact that we've cross-appealed. But I think that's the context that we have to work with here. And it's in that context that I think it's, and the court's questions get to one of the basic issues here, which is the standard of review. And I think on these issues, it is whether the decisions of the trial court were clearly erroneous. That's the Tiger versus Anderson case that we cited. It's not a de novo review here. These are factual determinations in which the court made a very diligent effort to find facts and express what she determined the facts to be. So we are operating, I believe, under a clearly erroneous standard. Only if there were no facts to support the decision of the trial judge that she made as to was there a meeting of the minds, was there a contract here, then would this court have the ability to say we're reversing here, we need to go back and start over again.
So excuse me, Mr. Yes. Witsit, you're talking about that particular standard of review applying to the issue of whether or not a contract exists.
That's correct. That was my statement there, but in fact, I think that clearly erroneous standard applies as well to the other issues. Because I think they're all essentially fact-weighted issues. Everything here, there is not a de novo issue of law, but issues of fact decided by the trial court. Was there a meeting of the minds? Was there intent or knowledge involving the issue of the excessive lien? And again, there were half a dozen separate factual findings that the court made with respect to each of those issues. It's just not supportable to argue here that this is a decision of law in which you have a de novo review. You would have to go in and look at those findings and say, well, we just disagree with that finding of fact. And that's not what this court is here for, even if you would have made a different decision yourselves, were you the trial court. Your position is not to substitute your judgment on these issues of fact, but only to point out and reverse clear error. Now, and I want to get to one of the other questions that arose with respect to this issue, because I think it is an important one. There is no reason for us to be arguing a contract question here. There was not a contract pled at the trial court. It was not pled in the initial complaint in this case. And it's interesting to note that 30 days before the trial, the court gave plaintiff the opportunity to amend the complaint and add claims, which they did, and still did not add a claim for breach of contract. At the trial, in the openings, it was stated that there is no contract claim here, and yet we went through the trial in this case, and there was no motion at trial to conform to the evidence that add a breach of contract complaint to conform to the evidence. There is no contract claim here. And to raise that issue for the first time on appeal is just simply not acceptable.
Let me ask you a question. You just mentioned, yet we went to trial. So the trial did include evidence about the breach of this express agreement that the McDonald's are alleging that your client said, I'll do it for $250,000. So in substance, wasn't there a claim, a breach of express contract claim, and that was tried by consent by the party?
It's interesting. It wasn't tried by consent because, in fact, it was pointed out that there was no contract claim. And we maintained through trial that we were not trying a claim by plaintiffs of breach of contract. We pointed it out again in closing. The defendant in this case, as an alternative, pled quantum merit or contract, and argued, we don't really think there is a contract, but if the court finds contract, we believe it is this. And it's interesting that counsel really admitted before you this morning today that there was no contract, because what he said, remember the argument is, well, the contract was either one of two things. It's clear that it was one of two things. Well, if one party thinks it's one thing and one party thinks it's the other thing, that's the essence of a failure of a meeting of the minds.
Let me ask you a question about that. So the court here found that there was no meeting of the minds and there was no contract. But clearly, the McDonough's wanted a renovation of this condominium. I mean, that's what they hired your client for, and your client agreed to do it. And so what if your client had, what if one of the parts that everybody agreed they were supposed to do was, I don't even know if this is in the record, just taking an example, they were supposed to fix up the master bedroom, and he just didn't do it, he just failed to do it. Would they have a claim against you?
Under the case, as the court decided, first of all, there was no agreement. There was no final agreement as to scope of the contract.
But now there was agreement on something.
So if they obviously both thought there was some level of agreement because both the parties proceeded. But the point is, and the court found that there was in fact no agreement as to either price or scope. So this would get in again to these nitty-gritty factual determinations by the court. And you're posing the question, what if the court had found there was agreement between the parties that there was going to be a renovation of the bedroom and it wasn't done, and plaintiffs had sued and said, wait a second, you agreed to do the whole job for this, including a renovation of the bedroom. Under that, as you pose it, under that set of findings by the court, there would be a breach of contract, and we would be responsible. What the court found, in fact, was there was no such agreement. The parties didn't understand. Both parties thought they knew what the scope was, but they each had a different concept. And if you read it, there again, there were 10 or 15 different factual findings in numbered paragraphs relating to that. The court found both of the parties had unreasonable expectations as to what they thought the contract was. The McDonough's thinking, we're going to get everything we want for $250,000, no matter what we ask for, no matter how long it takes, no matter what goes into it. And on the other hand, felt that Jankula was unreasonable in not making more clear to the McDonough's exactly what it meant by this discount down to $250,000, which trial judge found was based on an estimate for which there was no clear scope of work, no final determination as to costs in several various areas. So again, this is completely infused with factual determinations by this court, what the parties knew, what the parties understood, what they thought they knew, and it all gets into this meeting of the minds that is absolutely, and this is a fundamental difference between our position and that of the appellants, is that this is, if anything is a factual determination and must be addressed by this court on a clearly erroneous standard rather than a de novo.
Mr. Whitsitt, excuse me, let me ask you a question and go back to your issue about the plaintiff's pleadings. Didn't the plaintiffs file a claim for breach of implied contract?
Yes, they did, Your Honor, and counsel referenced that in his opening contract, in his opening statement, and I think this court needs to look at that because implied contract is not contract. And yes, once the decision has been made by the court that there's an implied contract, there is essentially no difference between an implied contract and a contract. But the court needs to consider what that is. An implied contract is the equivalent of quantum merit. It's the same claim as quantum merit. Quantum merit is the claim that compensates a party for having granted a benefit to the other side without a contract. So the court implies a contract under quantum merit. And the key is that quantum merit or implied contract supplies a reasonable value to the benefit that was conveyed. Jankula Construction conveyed a benefit to the McDonough's. The court found there was no contract. The court, in fact, found that there was an implied contract. That was the decision that the court made, that Jankula was entitled to recover on quantum merit or implied contract. But you don't enforce an implied contract and say, oh, by the way, part of that implied contract, I'm going to imply that you agreed to $250,000 and that's all you're going to get. The reason it's implied is because it's based on the finding that there was no agreement. So you fall back in implied contract to the quantum merit standard to reasonable value. And it's important for this court to look at that because the trial court was very clear in, again, four or five different paragraphs in saying the reasonable value that was given to the McDonough's was $395,000 worth of work. That was the reasonable value. And that's the linchpin that supports that this does not support an excessive lien claim, because under quantum merit, Jankula should have been able to recover all of that $395,000 and under the lien statute, lien for the value of its services, which the court found was $395,000. So there is no basis for an excessive lien claim. The mechanics lien statute is a remedial statute that was passed by this legislature to protect companies like Jankula Construction who provide benefits to owners and are not paid. And it needs to be construed liberally to support that. Only when there is knowledge and intent to defraud or cheat should this excessive lien statute be invoked against a lien holder in this case. And once again, the court made specific findings of fact that there was no knowledge to support an excessive lien claim that Ken, and that was in finding, I think it was number 135, that, no, I'm sorry, that was a different, but there was a finding that Ken Jankala had no knowledge that this lien was excessive. And for the court to even get to that question, she really confused this implied contract and quantum merit issue, because while she found that the value provided by Jankala was $395,000, she determined for a reason which we think is erroneous, that they really only had the right to lien for about $165,000, reducing that by the $26,000 discount counsel referred to. Well, the point is, there is no discount if there was no agreement to a discount. The only way you get to a discount is if there was a meeting of the minds, and that was the agreement. So for her to have decided there was no contract, and then to turn back on the excessive lien and say, well, wait a second, we've got to apply the discount that was agreed to, it's internally inconsistent. And this is where I said we take issue with one of the things the court did. We agree with the outcome that she came to, that there was no excessive lien. We think that the trial court got to it the wrong way.
How much was the lien for?
The lien filed was $116,000 in addition, and that has to be added to the $270,000. It's undisputed that the McDonoughs had paid already. So we're talking about $386,000 for a full for the full value of the lien plus what was paid.
But why should the lien cover the $270,000 if it's already been paid?
It didn't. The lien was $116,000.
But I thought you said you have to add the...
Well, you add that together to get to what was the total amount, because all of her findings were as to the value conveyed or the value provided to the McDonoughs, which was $395,000. The lien plus what was paid was $386,000. Jankala's books and the finding of the court as to the value of what was done was $395,000. Thank you very much. We appreciate your attention.
The trial court acknowledges a promise or an offer was made to do the job for $250,000. The trial court's question is, what did the party mean when it said that? It's important in this context to keep in mind that ambiguity is a question of contract interpretation, not formation. This is not a case of two ships called the Peerless that set sail from different ports on different days, where, you know, we're all familiar with that famous case study where the parties were relying upon objective different facts that were present at the time of contracting. Here, in contrast, we actually have one party trying to inject an ambiguity in a plain statement based on its unexpressed subjective intent that it never said to anyone until long after the fact. Regarding the scope of work, none of the details, the faux painting, the washer dryer, the amount of tile, are essential terms of a contract. They don't defeat the purpose of the contract. They don't frustrate its it being carried out. And so to suggest that these unessential details somehow prevent the formation of a contract is simply incorrect. That's the whole reason you have change orders, and that is the whole reason the Colorado jury instructions expressly contemplate that the price of a contract is that which is agreed upon, plus or minus any adjustments that are later agreed upon by the parties. Finally, with respect to the question again of whether or not breach of contract was at issue, it was pled. It was litigated by consent. The Tenth Circuit in Kirk v. U.S. Says the quote, "This court has said that the elements of an express and implied contract are the same," unquote. to suggest that an implied contract is somehow one and the same with a quantum merit claim is simply incorrect. Any further questions from the court? Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. And this concludes our oral arguments for this docket, and the court will be in recess. Thank you.
All right. The court will be in recess, subject to call.